Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the OVA1 and other multi-marker serum tests related to ovarian cancer testing. At this time, all participant lines are in a listen-only mode. Throughout the call, we will be conducting a question-and-answer session after each presentation. To ask a question via the phone, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. At this time, I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Awadale. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Jamaria. Good afternoon, and I'd like to welcome everyone to this Contractor Advisor Committee meeting, aka CAC. The purpose of our call today is to obtain advice from our CAC members about the strength of the published evidence on use of the OVA1 and other multi-marker serum tests related to ovarian cancer testing and assessing malignancy risk in adnexal masses in women with planned surgery. In addition to the discussion, the CAC members will vote on pre-distributed questions. All speakers must have completed and returned the disclosure statement prior to today's call. The meeting is also open to the public as observers. Well, as we all know, due to the nature of the topic that we have today, the specialties involved are prone or there's an increased possibility of emergencies, and such has happened today. So there are some people who had requested or had turned in, had indicated that they would be on the call, but their schedules today, emergencies have not permitted everyone to attend. So I just wanted to let everyone on the call know that. Okay. NGS does currently have OVA1 as a non-covered service in our LCD 33629, and we received a valid reconsideration request from Vermilion, which we are responding to in accordance with the Program Integrity Manual 100-08, which is an IOM manual, Internet-Only Manual, Chapter 13, Section 13.3.3. Before I go any further, I just wanted to give a quick review of the topic. So cancer of the ovary, fallopian tubes, and peritoneum is staged surgically, and the prognosis of ovarian cancer is closely related to the stage of the tumor at the time of diagnosis. If malignancy is detected while still localized in the ovary, the estimated five-year survival rate has been found to be about 92.5%. Conversely, five-year survival rates among women diagnosed with advanced-stage ovarian cancers range from 20 to 40%. Overall, early-stage diagnosis is correlated with higher five-year survival rates, thus establishing a need for early detection and intervention. Treatment options for ovarian cancer can vary. However, surgical intervention is commonly used to establish staging and disease confirmation. Currently, NCCN guidelines, together with ACOG and SGO guidelines, recommend that a woman with ovarian cancer should undergo surgery by a gynecological oncologist. However, it's estimated that about 33 to 60% of patients with ovarian cancer are treated by a gynecologist oncologist. That is, according to Eskander et al. In 2016 and the NCCN in 2017. Poor overall outcomes for ovarian cancer can be partially contributed to the asymptomatic nature of the disease. One potential identifying feature of ovarian cancer is the presence of an adnexal mass, a growth in the tissue in the adnexa of the uterus, which refers to a mass in the ovary, fallopian tube, or surrounding connective tissue. Estimates suggest that about 90% of all adnexal masses detected in premenopausal women and up to 60% of masses found in postmenopausal women are benign. However, the presence of an adnexal mass does carry a risk of malignancy. Initial diagnosis of adnexal masses relies on a variety of diagnostic modalities. This includes clinical examination, ultrasound assessment, more recently been included, two or more biomarker levels have been included, according to Abdallah et al. In 2016 and Anton et al. In 2012. So reliable screening tools that assess the risk of ovarian cancer for women who present with adnexal masses are paramount in providing optimum healthcare recommendations for patients, including referrals to gynecology oncology when appropriate. This is according to Yuelan, Ware Miller, and Anton et al., which we'll discuss a little bit later. Since we're here to discuss the literature, the literature that is surrounding these class of tests, I have sent out to our CAC members an annotated bibliography to help with this discussion today. Prior to going into this discussion, I would like to give Vermilion, our requester, an opportunity to present, and they had been informed that they could have a presenter to speak on the clinical utility of the test. Dr. Elizabeth Chereau's name was submitted as the person who would speak on their behalf today, and we will start off today's meeting with Dr. Chereau presenting. So, operator, if Dr. Chereau is on the line, you can unmute her line. And also, I just wanted to let our CAC members know that after Dr. Chereau finishes presenting, she has about 5 minutes. I've been informed by Dr. Yeager that Dr. Schulman will just speak for 1 to 2 minutes on his clinical experience. And after that, if we have any questions for them, if there are any questions for them from the CAC members, you can just indicate, as the operator would tell you how to do, and we can ask them of these questions before we move on to the next speaker. Thank you. Jamaria? Could we have Dr. Chereau?
Hello?
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 Is this Dr. Chereau?
This is Dr. Chereau. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Perfect. So I'm assuming everybody else can. Thank you for allowing me to address the committee for the use of OVA1 for women with adnexal masses. I just want to let you know my background is that I'm a generalist, so I'm an OBGYN. I've been in practice for about almost 20 years.
Sorry, Dr. Chereau. Okay, you're good. Could you also include your conflict of interest, if any?
There's none. I'm a generalist who uses OVA1 but has no financial stake background or anything with Vermilion, if that helps. So I was asked because, honestly, and I guess I'll start with my clinical case. I had a couple of years ago, a woman with an adnexal mass in her 60s who never complained of anything, and you know, I only had seen her for annual exams, came in, did an exam, I didn't feel anything. I sent her for ultrasound. She had a mass. It wasn't really diagnostic for anything that was cancerous, and the short speech here is that her OVA1 was positive. And I didn't have a GYN oncologist to refer to in my own institution. I had to send her out, and, you know, God forbid I had taken her to the OR myself, would have found cancer and would not have been able to take care of her properly. So I did send her out and actually diagnosed a stage 1 cancer, which, honestly, in my 19 years is really unheard of. We usually always see them in the third stage. So, you know, if an adnexal mass is discovered in a woman, a biopsy really is contraindicated because, as most of, I'm assuming, people on the phone know, that the tumor, you know, will spill into the abdomen and that increases stage. So physician assessment and imaging studies, really ultrasound, are helpful, but a large number of patients with adnexal masses benefit from the use of tumor markers to help decide if malignancy is a risk and if referral to gynecologic oncologists is necessary. So I want to point out that CA125 is indicated for use as an aid in the detection of residual or recurrent ovarian carcinoma and for use in monitoring patients for disease progress or response to therapy. OVA1 is indicated for women who are over the age of 18, have an adnexal mass present for which surgery you're planning for. but you haven't yet referred to an oncologist. So the OVA1 test is an aid to further assess the likelihood that malignancy is present when the physician's independent clinical and radiological evaluation does not indicate malignancy. The test is not intended as a screening or standalone diagnostic assay. So to speak to the publications, there's published data has shown that OVA1 has higher sensitivity in detecting ovarian malignancy than both CA125 and ROMA. This is especially true in premenopausal women, where the majority of pelvic masses are found, and in pre- and postmenopausal women with early-stage disease, just like the example I gave you today. The ability to detect ovarian cancer when there are no other obvious signs of malignancy allows women with early-stage disease to be appropriately referred to the GYN oncologist and have a proper staging. OVA1 also detects non-epithelial cancers that CA125 does not. There have been four recent publications independent of Vermilion and have shown that African-American women have lower CA125 levels in both the healthy state, high-risk patients, and women with ovarian cancer. Data recently presented at the American Association of Cancer Research and at the Mid-Atlantic GYN Society highlights the lack of sensitivity of CA125 in this particular population. OVA1 has demonstrated superior sensitivity for detection of malignancy in the African-American population. So recent guidelines have been updated to include and favor OVA1 over CA125 or ROMA in evaluation preoperatively for women with adnexal masses. The American College of OBGYN, so ACOG, which most of us follow as generalists, recently elevated OVA1 from non-coverage to a level B recommendation, which is a big move in the clinical management guidelines for OBGYNs. For the evaluation and management of adnexal masses. So level B is the highest level recommendation possible for OVA1, as it's not indicated to replace the level A recommendation, which is really ultrasound and physical exam. So the guidance provided by ACOG represents the most relevant guideline to managing adnexal masses at onset and to use in determining medical policy in OVA1. Not only does it emphasize that OVA1 has demonstrated higher sensitivity and negative predictive value for ovarian malignancy when compared with clinical impression alone, but also emphasizes that, quote, CA125 measurement is less valuable in predicting cancer risk in premenopausal women than in postmenopausal women, unquote. So UpToDate, which a lot of us go to, recently published a report on adnexal mass guidelines, reiterating support for OVA1. The report references and supports the ACOG guidelines regarding referral to GYN onc for women proceeding with surgical evaluation of adnexal mass that is highly, you know, suspicious of ovarian cancer. And they state that given the available evidence, we suggest OVA1, OVERA, or ROMA rather than CA125 to decide whether a patient who is planned for surgical evaluation for an adnexal mass should be referred to a GYN oncologist. Test availability and expense may factor in which test is most appropriate for each clinical situation. So as I said, you know, in the last 7 years, I have used OVA1. I find it really allows me to refer patients appropriately to GYN oncologist and honestly lets me reassure myself that I properly manage patients with benign conditions. Personally, I find that, you know, preoperatively, if you're prepared for surgery, that gets your patient the best outcome. They're great studies that it's not just, you know, who the surgeon is, but what the surgeon is and how they prepped the patient for surgery. So I found cases where ultrasound and CA125 and ROMA would have led me to believe that a patient had a benign condition and an elevated OVA1 determined patient had early stage ovarian cancer. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I know other Medicare contractors have a positive coverage policy for OVA1, and a growing number of commercial insurers now cover OVA1. So if I can turn this over, I think it's Dr. Schulman that's speaking next, so I can be muted. And then you good?
Yeah, thank you very much. If you can,
I can stay on the line. I'm happy to stay on the line. I too might have an emergency as I'm on labor and delivery today, but I will stay on the line as long as I can.
It's just for a couple more minutes till Dr.
Coleman. Yeah, no, absolutely.
We'll put it out to the public, if up to the CAC members if they have any questions. Thank you very much. Jamaria, could you open Dr. Schulman's line next, please?
That's star 1 to open your line. Star and the number 1.
I don't believe Dr. Shulman. Okay, if he's not on the line yet, because I don't see him on the line, could we ask the CAC members if they have any questions for Dr. Sherrill to please ask them of her now?
I think Dr. Shulman just texted me that they're on the line. Says on.
Yes.
There you are.
Oh,
perfect.
Hello.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Everyone can hear me?
Yeah,
yep.
I can hear you.
Okay. So my name is Lee Shulman. I'm a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern University in Chicago. I am an OBGYN geneticist, and part of my research and clinical responsibilities is to run the ovarian cancer early detection program. In Chicago here. It probably is the largest ovarian cancer early detection program with over 3,700 women participating, mostly as a result of inherited mutations that predispose to ovarian cancer, but also because of family history. I know you had wanted to know about disclosures. I, as opposed to the previous speaker, I am a consultant for Vermilion and have received compensation for consulting, but receiving obviously no compensation or any monies for today. I think she gave a wonderful overview. I can't further emphasize the critical importance of an effective triage for women with an adnexal mass. Even in a high-risk population that I serve here in Chicago and really throughout the Midwest and around the United States, the ability to provide that information despite having a large GYN oncology service readily available makes for an incredible difference in the quality of care that women receive. Our GYN oncologists, much like the rest of our services, are very busy. And clearly one of the issues here is not to clog up the GYN oncology service with benign cases, nor to have women who ultimately have cancer to be cared for surgically by general OBGYN surgeons who do not have the expertise for optimal staging at the initial point. I think it's incredibly important to understand that still in the United States, all too many women are being taken to an operating room without triage, are being evaluated surgically, found to have an ovarian malignancy, and then because the surgeons don't have the skill to, requisite skill to continue the staging procedure, are closed up and then sent off for a GYN oncology assessment that usually happens 4 to 6 weeks later. It's been evaluated in this way that just that particular act reduces that woman's expected life expectancy by up to 25%. So if we are truly going to be able to optimize the care, not just the high-risk women that I see, but all women who present with an adnexal mass, and that's about 300,000 women in the United States each year, we have been without an effective triage approach. Ultrasound detects the adnexal masses for the most part. CA-125, as you heard, is only been approved for the evaluation of women with ovarian cancer to monitor recurrence. It has been used because there has been nothing else, and it's clear that every professional society knows and discourages the use of CA-125 just because it's a nonspecific assay that is found to be positive in a lot of women with benign disease. Yes?
Okay, if you can just wrap it up about 30 seconds.
Sure. Again, as I said earlier, I can't emphasize the importance of OVA1 and this algorithm. It's been shown to be equal to or better than the other algorithms that are there, and it truly helps to improve clinical outcomes for women with cancer as well as women without cancer.
Okay, thank you very, very much. So, operator, could we find out if anybody, any of our CAC members on the line, on the participant line, have any questions of either Dr. Shiro or Dr. Shulman?
Again, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. That's star and the number one. And your first question comes from Robert Babkowski.
Yeah, hi. It's Dr. Babkowski. I'm the Chief of Pathology and the Laboratory Medical Director here at Stanford Health System. We have an active OBGYN program, GYN Oncology program, and the question really is for both Dr. Shiro and Dr. Sherman. The data, clearly the CA125 is not a good biological marker for African-American women. It's clearly a analyte that, you know, I in the laboratory hate because, you know, there's just too many, there's too many false elevations and too many false depressions, and it's not a good marker. I think we all know that. The real issue is the population that we would be applying this to and the utility of OVA1 in the premenopausal and the postmenopausal setting. Can we talk more about those two populations? Because do you believe that OVA1 is as effective in the postmenopausal adnexal mass group as it is in the, you know, premenopausal folks? I'll take either one or both of you.
So Dr. Shulman, Dr. Shiro, could either of you speak to that or
not? So I'm not sure Dr. Shulman's still on the line.
Hello.
Oh, perfect. Go ahead, Dr. Shulman.
Okay. Thank you for your question. The answer is you're dealing with two very separate demographics, and the reality is that this triage is specifically for women with an adnexal mass. It is not a screening assay, and it's specifically not a screening assay. So you're talking about, again, the 300,000 or so women in the United States that present with an adnexal mass. It's not for women with BRCA mutations. It's not for women with a fibroid uterus. It's an adnexal mass. And we have shown, and it's not just we have shown, it has been shown, that OVA1 provides a far greater positive predictive value and negative predictive value, first of all, than CA125. And also better than the somewhat better than the ROMA algorithm as well. So not only does it provide value clearly for the premenopausal population who have the most number of adnexal masses, it also provides important information for the postmenopausal population because while their risk of cancer is increased, a postmenopausal woman with an adnexal mass has a higher likelihood that adnexal mass is malignant. It again provides valuable information to know whether or not that woman can be operated on in a secondary or a community-based hospital with a skilled gynecologic surgeon, or whether or not she is best cared for in an oncological surgical center with GYN oncologists or surgical oncologists. So the value of OVA1 has been shown both in premenopause and postmenopause. Is the value somewhat better one than the other? It's probably a little better in the premenopause. But the reality is that whether we're talking premenopause or postmenopause, it is profoundly better than CA125 in either of those populations.
I guess I would just add that it you know, the OVA1 definitely has demonstrated the superior sensitivity in the African American population specifically.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions out there, operator? I don't see anybody on the queue. Okay. Well, thank you.
I have one more coming off the leader line. This is Dr. Larry Clark. I'm one of the medical directors. And I just wanted to ask Dr. Shiro, because I'm not sure what the differential diagnosis is, but in your particular patient who you said was in her 60s,
yeah,
you're not talking about the more advanced age of a woman in the reproductive range who had undergone, let's say, ovarian hyperstimulation. You clearly have a woman who is postmenopausal with the presentation of an adnexal mass. How did you treat that? I mean, what is the differential beyond the strong presumption of neoplasm of one of the different types of ovarian cancer? And why would you not treat every woman of that age group? You know, we're asked to
great question
to Medicare
yeah.
Bennies. So let's tailor
no, no, no.
to the
great,
Medicare Bennies.
Great question. So this is a patient who actually had no family history, came in, somebody who I really only saw for annual exams, not somebody who, I took took her pain kind of seriously, brought her in, did an exam. I didn't feel anything on her exam. I guess I'm in New Jersey, so average weight for New Jersey, a BMI in her, mid-30s. And, I would love to tell you my clinical exam of 19 years that I could, pick up a 4-centimeter mass.
Right.
Yes, did her ultrasound as dutifully as, any obstetrician would, and chose not to send the CA-125, but chose to send the OVA-1. The bigger issue here is there was no ascites. I mean, I would love to tell you that I'm really good. I think that the OVA-1 pushed me to, absolutely pushed me to say, I'm not going to take this out. I'm not going to have a backup oncologist on standby, which I didn't even have in my institution at the time because we were in between GYN oncologists. So I really needed to know, did I need to take her? Did somebody else need to take her? I wasn't really worried about torsion. You're absolutely right. In a postmenopausal woman with a 4-centimeter cyst, I should be suspicious. I'm suspicious all the time. I would love to be able to, because it's deadly. And had I said mm-hmm. to her, why don't you come back, in 3 more weeks and we'll see if it's worse. To be frankly honest, I was thinking maybe appendix, et cetera. And again, pelvic pain in a 6-year-old woman is not something that usually walks into my office. Mm-hmm. So, what could that cyst have been there for a very long time? I have multiple women who have cysts that I can quickly say, listen, this looks not suspicious, right? No calcifications on the ultrasound, no papillations. And by doing, there's no indication to do a CA-125, right? There's really an indication to do the OVA-1. So, and that would determine, and honestly, if her pain, I might have said this is really maybe GI, maybe this ovarian cyst had been there for years. I just happened to have caught it today. So,
would you just explain that sentence you said was, I felt the need to do the OVA-1, and you made a discrimination from the CA-125.
Right.
What made you choose this test over the standard marker?
But the standard marker, right, is indicated for the use, really for residual disease, right, mm-hmm. after the patient has been diagnosed. Because of what's out there in the lay public, many people come in and say, I want to see 125 without an adnexal mass, without anything. And what I'm, really trying to do is diagnose somebody with better sensitivity and specificity with cancer. And preoperatively, I thought, well, okay, could this have been either, just a serous cyst adenoma, for the pathologist that's out there, right? Just a benign cyst that I could take to the OR as a generalist, feel very comfortable that she's getting the right care. My choice was to do something that would make a difference in her care and her management. And I had to have this patient drive believe it or not, in New Jersey, it was a significant, to a whole other hospital, a whole other system, which my, hospital would hate me for saying. Granted, 20 miles up the road doesn't seem very far, but for this particular patient, without her standard doctor, the rest of it was a difference. The difference to do it was because I wanted to know, could I take this patient to the OR, or my partner, if it torsed over the weekend, or was this something that an oncologist should really be taking care of? And this woman, obviously, was an oncologist that needed to be done. And really, it's because of the sensitivity and specificity that I'm trying to do the higher sensitivity in detecting ovarian malignancy. And that has been proven above, CA-125 and ROMA. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Clark. Any other questions?
At this time, I'm seeing there are no other questions in queue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Shiro and Dr. Shulman. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Operator, could you open up Dr. Zhang's line? Dr. Zhang will introduce himself, tell us a little bit about himself and any disclosures. He did fill out a conflict of interest paper prior to today, but I just wanted to indicate that Dr. Zhang has been invited to the call today to discuss the analytical validity. He is someone that I came across while reading the article and found out that he's from Johns Hopkins University and actually had been involved in the actual discovery of the test. So I reached out to him to speak to us, to speak to the, to help us out, as the, not help us out, but to speak to us at the CAC about the analytical and clinical validity of OVA1, but since that's the main one that is being reconsidered. But yes, that's it. So if you could open Dr. Zhang's line, please.
Hello,
his line is open.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. I can hear you, Dr. Zhang. Thank you for coming. You
sure.
May begin.
Okay, first I need to do a disclosure and a disclaimer. And one is that the OVA1 and also its second generation product, Overa, was developed that partially supported by a sponsored research agreement between Vermilion, the company, and Johns Hopkins University, which he has since about 2 years ago ended. The other thing is both OVA1 and Overa was licensed to Vermilion by Johns Hopkins University. And since I'm one of the co-inventors, I'm entitled to royalty payment, but I still keep my Johns Hopkins job. So the other one is I'm currently also involved from time to time as a statistical consultant for Vermilion for new product development, and don't have anything to do with the OVA1 marketing or operation. It's 10 years ago. So also, because of that, I do not have direct knowledge of the current usage of OVA1 in the clinic. The description and some of the opinion I said today is going to be, one is the best to my knowledge, and also memory of some of the things that quite a while ago. And as a rule, individual as a scientist with first-hand knowledge, but it's not the opinion or position of Johns Hopkins University. We're essentially required to state that. Then I come down to that. One is when it's developed, we have several multi-center studies, and essentially there's the biomarkers used in the OVA1 was discovered through a multi-center studies about 350 patients from five institutions, actually from Netherlands, Duke, from Royal Hospital for Women in Sydney, and MD Anderson, and Johns Hopkins Universities. All those data goes through the discovery process. Now, after that, we have several papers, and one of the things decision to go through to development of OVA1 is actually there are about 1,800 samples from six medical institutions across the world. And we use one of the center data to essentially mathematically derive the algorithm, and this is not OVA1, just when we first started, we were trying to do that to see whether it's going to work, from one particular institution and tested on our five institutions. And there's altogether about 1,800 samples, and it has a very consistent separation from one institution to another to another. That gives essentially the green lights for the company, Vermilion. That time is actually not in name, it's different, to commit the resource and the funding for the actual development and the eventual clinical trial for that. Part of the things I want to say, which is very relevant to today's discussion, is that when you have a test like that, and you typically people talking about the ROC curve and how well is the ROC curve, but actually there is always one particular operating point how the test is going to be used. So essentially, where do you choose your cutoff point? They're going to give you the sensitivity and specificity, and also the corresponding PPV predictive values, both negative and positive predictive values. That's for the OVA1. When we was looking at it, we used four criteria. One is, what is the size of the test population? For OVA1, it's relatively small. And what's the prevalence of the cancer in that particular test population? For OVA1, since that's for women with pelvic mass and a decision to have surgery, more or less is made that because of a perceived risk of ovarian cancer. So that prevalence is, from the two studies we have, is about 20 to 30%, so it's relatively high. And then the consequence of false negative, it is significant because ovarian cancer is a very deadly disease. But since the decision to have a surgery is already done, the question is who's going to do the surgery. So it is significant, but it's not as bad as just totally missed altogether. On the other hand, the false positive, the consequence of false positive is that it's actually relatively insignificant. Most part is the cost money you're going to involve to have a specialist to do a surgery, and also the essentially inconvenience to go to a place to have the surgery. So with all those four criteria, four parameters in it, and essentially with this, it's determined with us and also the other people, opinion leaders in the field, is that we need something actually with a very high sensitivity. And also because that the OVA1 actually is the first ever clear test by FDA for multiple protein biomarker combined as a single index assay. So part of things for FDA is the efficacy and safety is really issue, and to have the high sensitivity looking at this criteria make it relatively easier to actually have the test that go through the whole process. So it is by design that we choose a relatively high sensitivity, so somewhere around 90 to 95% in that range, depending on different data set. But in that range, sensitivity, and then to select the cutoff. Once the cutoff decided, we went through multiple studies, including the second, the company run multiple studies and other people. The sensitivity is more or less keep very consistently high. And I think the part of other things I want to say about it is that the test is not meant to be as a diagnostic decision, like essentially whether you have a disease or not. It's more as a differentiation of the risk. And I think the key things to look at is the for those population, prior to the test, the prevalence is somewhere around 20 to 30%. And the, after the test, because we actually the original validation study has a high prevalence of 31%. After the if the test positive, the PPV is 42%. So it's about a 10 or 11% improve enrichment of the cases in the test positive population. However, because it's designed with a very high sensitivity, the negative predictive value is about 92% for that 92.7. So it's about 93%. So essentially, before the test, you have a 31% chance of having cancer. After test, if the test is negative, that chance reduced to about 3%. So that's it's about sevenfold or so more reduction. In the second validation study by Bristol and a group, it is the prevalence before the test is by 18.6%. After that, if you are positive, your probability becomes 31%. But if you are negative, the probability is less than 4%. So again, it's a significant reduction. And that's, I think, the key point when it's designed for that purpose. It's not by chance. It's actually before the study, the algorithm derivation, we made a decision that's where we want to go, and we're for that. The other issue is the analytical precision of the test that I want to just quickly go through. But it is also a first because it's the first ever been cleared by FDA, and I actually worked with Dr. Kondratovich, who is head of a statistician over FDA, to come up with she made a suggestion, I made some modifications, eventually did that. Essentially, each of the individual analyzed goes into the OVA1 algorithm, has a precision profile, essentially what's the CV and across the whole entire range. Then we have the actual clinical study population. The patient, you have the five, like if you have the five analyzed values. And for each of the value, analyzed values, because we know it could be analytically vary up and down by chance. So we use something called Monte Carlo simulation to generate data around those points, simulate when the assay has variation for this particular patient, how it's going to affect the OVA1 result. So, and this is done with all the patients across the whole study sections and generates lots of points. And that's actually at the end, with the exception of one place around the OVA1 equal to 4, the CV is about 6% or so. The rest all across the whole range, the CV is less 5%. Actually, the CV is less than the individual analyzed CV. And that, because of that work, actually, I think that's become an acceptable method for those kind of IVDMI precision analysis for all the other people doing this in the field. So finally, to summarize, I don't have a point I want to make. One is OVA1 is an in vitro diagnostic multivariate index assay. It combines the markers with complementary values to improve the overall performance. So in some way, actually, it covers better than the individual markers for the different histotypes just because it uses multiple markers. And the other thing is that we were able to show, and actually it's also through the algorithm derivation process that make OVA1 has a very high assay precision. I think that's all I have for this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zhang. I actually have a couple of questions, which it could be one, it could be two, but I'll ask them. And while I'm asking that, operator, if you could, before I start asking, if you could just queue up and ask the CAC members if they have any questions so that we can start to have them come in the queue. And after you finish that, I'll then start my own asking my question, Dr. Zhang, okay? So if we let the operator ask.
Once again, as a reminder, if you have a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star one to ask a question.
Thank you, Dr. Maria. Okay, so Dr. Zhang, thank you very much for the presentation. I do have a couple of questions. The first one is, you did mention that there were small population sizes, for most of these studies. And my first question is, especially in light of what Dr. Chereau had said earlier, was there an ability to separate out these in terms of analyzing the data, taking into consideration the fact that different ethnic groups, especially African-Americans, like she had mentioned, have potentially CA-125 results that could be deceptive. So, you know, that's the reliability of CA-125. Mm-hmm. Was there an ability to look at your data from that aspect as well when you were evaluating OVA1?
Well, the original, when the OVA1 gets to FDA clearance, there's a validation study, and there are subtypes and also basic ethnic groups information. Actually, I wasn't prepared for that question, so I didn't have the list in front of me. There are some in it, but let me come to this. Essentially, my impression, again, because each individual study, the actual subtype, like the clear cell, because in the U.S. it's a relatively small percentage. Each one of the studies may not have a sufficient number to draw a conclusion, but through multiple studies, we sort of see a very consistent pattern that actually OVA1 were able to detect those cancers.
Okay, and the reason I asked is because, as you know, with OVA1, ROMA, and OVERA, the common thing in all three of them is CA-125. Yeah. So I'm just asking how we're able to come up with the decision that, you know, it's the test and not the CA-125 that's also, you know, still kind of having some effect in there. How are we able to, you know, account for that? Because I thought that was really interesting that in OVA1, OVERA, and ROMA, you know, as much variation that they had, CA-125 was something that was common to all three of them.
Let me answer that question. One is actually something I was not able to show one of the slides I had, is that when I'm talking about the 1,800 patients that before we went into the development of OVA1, 1,800 patients, those the way that we are able to separate the patient and make the decision, actually those markers does not have CA-125 in it, because that's essential for us to prove those markers have a value for discriminating ovarian cancer from the others. However, when you actually do the product development, there's no reason not to include CA-125 And as a matter of fact, among all the marks of CA-125 would still be the most contributory marks among all the five markers. The other ones, however, because what happens for those is I'm getting into more technical details. When you combine multiple markers, it's not necessary two of the best markers combined together is going to always be better than one good marker and another not so good marker together, because it just needs to be complementary. If the two very good markers, but if they happen to be very overlapped in terms of performance, they miss the same patients and get the same patient, then the combination may not be as good as the one that was less good. The other markers that involve a lot of action, not necessarily as a, if we look what they are not necessarily as a directly as a driving force for causing the ovarian cancer, more as the result of having ovarian cancer. So that's
okay.
Part of the, I don't know if it's getting too technical over there, but in a way,
no.
We were able to see the ROC curves, especially for the premenopausal part, they are significantly better than CA-125.
Okay, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate you making time today to attend the meeting and to give the presentation. So thank you very much. And I do not see any further questions.
Okay.
Dr. Arvidelli?
Yes.
This is Dr. Haug. I just had a question. Earlier mention was made of the up-to-date. In the section on the evaluation of an adnexal mass, there's a chart that is referral of women with pelvic mass to a GYN oncologist, ACOG guidelines. Now, these guidelines do say 2011, but these are the ones that are listed in the current up-to-date, which is it's listed as last updated in March of this year. And it has two different sections, one for premenopausal women and one for postmenopausal women. But the only marker that's listed is an elevated CA-125. It doesn't mention anything else. And the other thing, nobody's mentioned NCCN guidelines. In the workup of a suspicion for ovarian cancer, in the section of workup OB-1, it has CA-125 or other tumor markers as clinically indicated, and then has a footnote, but the footnote doesn't include, it doesn't look like it includes OVA1 or ROMA at all. So I don't know if anybody could comment on that, on those two things, my observation about what's listed currently in the up-to-date and the lack of mention of OVA1 in the NCCN guidelines. That's all I had.
Thank you, Dr. Haug. I don't know if any of them are still on the line, but I will mention that what I noted with that is the fact that what is clearly indicated in terms of NCCN and ACOG guidelines is the fact that a gynonc should be doing the surgery if malignancy is highly suspected. It's suspected, so for better outcomes. But like you, OVA1 is not mentioned in the guidelines, and not only that, actually online, accessible online is the fact that OVA1 had actually requested to be included in the guidelines, and that had been voted down by the NCCN ovarian cancer panel about two or three times. So I just wanted to mention that in answer to your observation there. Thank you. Operator, I'm going to move. Okay, so I do have a question from an Eric Liu. Could you please open his line, please?
And hi, and Eric Liu's line is open.
Hello, I'm a pathologist over at Dartmouth. This is not my area of expertise, but I think you might have been looking at the wrong up-to-date thing, because I have that open right now, too. OVA1 and ROMA and those items like OVERA are also listed under the up-to-date write-up called Serum Biomarkers for Evaluation of an Adnexal Mass for Epithelial Carcinoma of the Ovary, Fallopian Tuber, Peritoneum. So you might have been looking at the wrong one. And the NCCN guidelines look like they also mention it, but I haven't had a chance to really look at that very clearly. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Okay, the latest NCCN guidelines are 2.2019, and actually they don't, even though the section says OV1, not to be confused with over one, they actually do not list over one as one of the recommendations.
Okay.
But we can certainly, you know, revisit that. So thank you for pointing that out. Okay, there are no other questions in the queue. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next section. So if you can mute, operator, if you can close the lines for Dr. Zhang, Dr. Shiro, and Dr. Ullman, that would be nice. Ullman, that would be appreciated. So I'm going to move on to the next section here and just talk a little bit about what we're going to do in terms of what to expect in terms of the voting aspect and everything, and then we'll go on to the discussion. So we're going to move on to the next one, which would be to discuss the voting questions. And I just wanted to say that we won't be voting real time, but if I would really appreciate that people would return the Excel spreadsheet that was sent out, would vote using the Excel spreadsheet and return that within a week of today's meeting so that we can tally up the votes. And I also want to say that individual voting is not going to be released, but it's going to be an aggregate voting score that will be published online along with the minutes at a later date. So I don't know if Dr. Brewer was able to join. She was going to join. She's one of our PAC members. Is Dr. Brewer? I don't see her name. Okay.
Yes, I'm on the line.
Oh, you are. Thank you very much, Dr. Brewer.
Yeah, I've been on. I called in just a couple minutes late. So.
Okay. Yes, you had. I really appreciate you coming on. So, do you have any comments or anything that you would like to say concerning what I don't know what all you were able to hear?
I heard everything. And I guess, you know, from my perspective, I went through this whole bibliography fairly carefully. And, you know, the data is really all over the place. And I think the two most important papers from my perspective are Laura Havrileski's paper, which looks at the cost effectiveness for women with an adnexal mass. And her conclusion was that referral of all patients with a complex ovarian mass is the least expensive, and that all of these patients ended up getting managed by a gynecologic oncologist. And Kim, I don't know his first name, he was a 2012 paper, showed essentially the same thing. And so, you know, I followed this OVA1 literature pretty carefully, and, you know, their sensitivity is high, but their positive predictive value, they essentially don't report most of the time. And that's the thing that I'm the most interested in. So I think that, you know, I think that OVA1 misses some patients. I think it overcalls some patients. I think that's true of all of the, you know, all of the things that we have in our armamentarium. But, you know, if we're looking at cost effectiveness and best practice, I can't endorse the OVA1 as being, you know, the number one test.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wants to respond to what Dr. Brewer said or add to it or comment on what she said? Operator, could you ask?
This is Dr. Clark. I'd just like to ask Dr. Brewer if she could be a little more specific on what she said. I think the first statement you made was one that I don't know whether you heard my statement earlier, but basically I was just talking about the wisdom of referring all postmenopausal complex ovarian masses or treating all of them as though they are cancer until proven otherwise, which means managing them as an oncologic surgery. I think we're in agreement. Is that what you just said?
That is what I just said. And, you know, and I speak from the, I'm an oncologist, and so I speak from that perspective that, you know, I would rather evaluate these patients than have them be missed. And so if you use, postmenopausal women are the highest risk for having a cancer. And I think that, you know, I think it's appropriate to refer them. That's part of what's, you know, what's been shown through SGO and ACOG is that these patients, you should have a low threshold for referring these patients.
Thank you. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else on the line? Operator, could you check if anybody else on the line has any comments or questions?
Absolutely. If anybody would like to ask a question or pose a comment at this time, press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Okay. Okay, Doctor, could you open up Dr. Babkowski's line, please?
Absolutely. His line is open.
Yeah, hi. It's Dr. Babkowski again. I have a question, just a general question. You know, I do believe the data does support the observation that these tests are better than, you know, just using CA125 as a test. So I think from a pathologist perspective, I think the analytical positive predictive value, okay, is higher with OVA1 than CA125. So when I look at it in terms of a better of you know the next I'm thinking of it as a more of a next generation test. My biggest concern, quite frankly, about this whole assay is that it's going to wind up being overused by docs who, quite frankly, are going to start using it as a screening test. And you know, I do think it needs to be used to, quite frankly, like in my institution, what I've noticed is that, you know, it's having the GYN oncologist, you know, on standby on the cases that are more likely to be positive, where this assay becomes useful. And again, it's a transfer of the patient to the right location. So it's more of a patient triage tool than anything else, and I think there's value in that. You know, Zhang's, you know, observations about using the test for that purpose I think are pretty valid. Although I do, you know, I see your point about the data, you know, being somewhat scattered. And I think that's part of the reason, by the way, why I didn't make it into the NCCN guidelines. So what are your thoughts on, is this a better mousetrap, essentially? Is this a better alternative than CA125? Because that's the question. Because for me, it really is.
Well, I think it depends on what parameters you're looking at. And I think, you know, I think the sensitivity of OVA1 is a little bit higher. I think the false positives is also higher in OVA1. I think that, you know, CA125 in the postmenopausal population is pretty good. And if you look at the characteristics of the, and this is something I didn't mention, but if you look at the characteristics of the mass on ultrasound, that's also pretty good in terms of who needs to be referred. And so you have to look at the whole patient. You have to look at all of the parameters. And I agree with you. I think that what I see is a lot of people are using OVA1 as a screening test, and it's not appropriate. You know, 15 years ago, they tried to get it approved, and we on at SGO came out pretty strongly and basically said there's not any data to use it as a screening test. So I think that you have to look at the whole patient. You know, every test you do is going to have false positives and false negatives. And if you just rely on one test to make a decision, I don't think that's good medicine.
No, I agree on that. Yeah.
I am thank you very much. And I also wanted to chime in. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Babkowski, you had mentioned, and maybe I misheard you, you had said something about the positive predictive value, or did you mean negative predictive value was high? Because you had said that it was a positive. I tend to agree with Dr. Brewer more from the literature and from what I read, that it's, you know, it's more of the high negative predictive value that could be useful as opposed to a positive predictive value.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what I meant. Sorry.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let me then ask you, one of the questions that we have on here is, how confident are you that there is adequate published evidence that the conclusions of the test below are generalizable to the typical Medicare patient population of 65 and older, which kind of piggybacks on what Dr. Clark had been saying when, you know, essentially we're talking postmenopausal, you know. So how confident are you on that there is, you know, what do you think about that in terms of published evidence that we have for our own typical population of Medicare, which is 65 and older?
Well, see, that's where I think the data is kind of lacking, which is why I asked the question, because I think this test is probably more useful in the under 65 than over 65. I don't think I have enough data to make that decision.
Yeah, I would agree 100%.
Okay, all right. And operator, could you just see if there's anybody else who has comments or would want to, you know, I mean, from our CAC members who would want to join in this discussion so we can open up their line as we speak?
Absolutely. If there are anyone else that has a question or would like to pose a comment at this time, they can press *1.
And while we're waiting on that, for Dr. Babkowski and Dr. Brewer, how confident are you about that there's adequate evidence that has been published that would aid in the assessment of likelihood of malignancy in women presenting with an ovarian adnexal mass prior to planned surgery? I think what I'm trying to say is what I heard Dr. Brewer say, and I tend to agree, is, you know, you have to take in the clinical presentation, the clinical picture of the woman, and also the ultrasound and the nature of the mass and all of that. And then if you're still, at least according to these tests, if you're still doubting that it's malignant, because I think what we're trying to establish here is that if you think it's malignant after all of that, you really should be referring to a gynecologist. But what these tests are saying is that if you're then still doubting or you feel like you're leaning more towards negative, then you should do these tests. And from what I'm reading, if it still is negative, then go ahead and do the surgery yourself. But it's positive. But if it's positive, go ahead and send them to the gynoc. Would you say that's pretty much what that is, or what is your take on that?
I think that's a reasonable assessment.
Yeah, I concur.
Okay, thank you. Okay, could you open open Dr. Liu's line, please, operator?
His line is open.
Okay. Hello. Thank you, Dr. Liu.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to get clarification because it sounded like, and what you guys had just said as well, that the screening test was really the clinical exam plus the ultrasound finding the adnexal mass, and that this test was supposed to be used to determine whether or not the patient needed to be referred to a specialist for their surgery. I'm not too clear as to whether or not the cost of doing this test would outweigh the additional burdens being placed on the specialists or not. Would anybody be able to clarify that?
So the FDA label, I just wanted to quickly jump in here, and then I'll let Dr. Brewer and Dr. Babkowski answer if they so choose. The FDA label specifically says that the person has to be 18 or older, you already have a mass, and you've already made a decision to go to surgery. Mm-hmm. So all three of those things exist. And then this test may be done to make sure, so the indication is to make sure that a gynonc does the surgery if it's malignant for better outcomes.
Sure.
Dr. Liu?
The question is, is it just cheaper to do the test in that situation rather than, you know, send the patient to a gyn-onc specialist? Thanks.
Well, so are you saying that, is it cheaper, like, if you do all of that and you're highly suspicious of, or you're not suspicious of malignancy?
Right. Like,
rather than
a better use of resources to do this test and spare the patient being referred to a specialist, you know, in the you know, clearly defined situation that was on the FDA approved label.
Well, you know, this meeting is really to discuss in terms of the literature concerning, you know, it's evidentiary. We're trying to look at the evidence and the literature that's out there and discuss that.
Sure. Okay.
So that's what I'll say to that. But Dr. Brewer, Dr. Babkowski, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, again, you know, I think there is merit to the test, but it's got to be very clearly defined. And the practicing OBGYN person, let me ask you a question. Is there an issue with access? Do you think there's an issue of access or adequate triage with the post-65 population? And again, I'm focusing post-65 because really that's the NGS covered lives population. I mean, is that, you know, because again, honestly, in my neck of the woods, getting access to a GYN oncologist is not difficult, you know. Getting GYN coverage
it's
is not difficult.
Where I am either.
Right. So.
And you know, the thing is that if you get into the rural, I mean, some of the data has shown if you get into the rural areas, the referrals are not, I mean, a lot of women are not managed by gyn-oncs, but they're, you know, doing this test wouldn't increase their referral to gyn-oncs as a problem.
Right.
So I think if we go back to the premise that 55 and older, so postmenopausal with a mass, right, increases the likelihood of the of it being malignant, would doing this test really decrease the number of people going to the gyn-onc?
I'm not convinced it would. I mean, but you're also talking about, it's not just a pelvic mass, it's a complex pelvic mass with high-risk features, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a simple cyst, you know, you don't need to do this test on.
Okay. All right. So I think we've discussed this, but I'll ask again, in terms of the analytical validity, in terms of the literature that is out there right now, how confident are you in the methods that were used for, you know,
I don't think most of the studies have large enough numbers.
Yes. So in my review of the literature, I would have to agree with you that that was the population. The other thing that I want to bring out is that a lot of the studies in terms of for over one, they used the same, there was overlap of the subjects, right? So there were three or four papers that came out of the same.
Right.
The same
cohort.
Right. The same set of people. So it really made that a little bit difficult, if you would. So the studies contained small sample sizes, like you had said. They were overlapping patient populations. They were studies that were funded by the test manufacturer, and they were the studies included patients that actually were evaluated by a gyn-onc, you know, which I think kind of skews it then.
Absolutely, it skews it.
It skews it because they were actually evaluated by a gyn-onc. So, and if the whole reason is to decide who goes to a gyn-onc and the gyn-onc is already evaluating the patient, then I think that does skew some of the results. So as far as clinical validity there, that those would be questions I would have. Dr. Babkowski, did you want to comment on that?
No, I mean, I'm agreeing with the comments that are being made. You know, I wish the data was a little bit more robust.
Okay. All right. Well, any other comments from the three of you?
I don't think so. I think it's been a good discussion.
Thank you very much. Operator, could you ask one more time if there's anybody on the line that would like to make a comment?
Absolutely. If anyone else would like to make a comment at this time, please press star one.
Okay, it doesn't seem like there's anybody. This has been a short meeting, and once again, I would like to thank everybody who was able to call in and has participated. I really appreciate you taking the time to do so. So I just wanted to remind everybody that of my voting members, in terms of CAC members, to please submit your results within the week. The sooner the better. Submit the results using the spreadsheet that was emailed to you. If you need us to resend one, please let us know. We would gladly do so. And I also want to remind you that only the aggregate, not the individual scores, will be published. And I strongly urge you, like I said before, to use the Excel spreadsheet. So I'm sure I speak for, you know, my colleagues and for our NGS, and we really appreciate people taking the time and everyone's participation in today's CAC. It will surely provide invaluable perspectives and information that will inform our future policy. So I had mentioned earlier on that at the end, if I had time, I would say something about the process. So the next thing now would be for us to just go mull over all this information that we've received and the evidence and stuff, and at a future date come up with a draft policy, which will then be posted publicly to be presented at a future open meeting. And so I strongly recommend that people keep posted by visiting our webpage often to see if there's any activity and what that is there. So that brings us to the end of this CAC meeting, and I guess I can say I give everybody back 45 minutes of their life, and I once again want to say thank you very much to all of you, especially Dr. Babkowski, Dr. Brewer, and Dr. Liu. Thank you very much, operator. You can now disconnect the call.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.
Thank you, operator.
You're welcome.